To hear previous Making Waves shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to let us know what you think of our show. We'd also love for you to volunteer with us. You can also call the station in the next hour for more info. That number is 430-9722. That's 430-WSCA. Now we bring you some people's history. On October 16th in 1992, Rigoberta Menchú of Guatemala won the Nobel Peace Prize. Here's an article from the Green Left Weekly in Australia from October 1992. Rigoberta Menchú wins Nobel Peace Prize by Robin Marshall. Mexico City held a huge party for Rigoberta Menchú Tum on October 20th to celebrate her winning of the Nobel Peace Prize. As soon as she heard the announcement, she had gone to Guatemala to speak with the indigenous Indian people on whose behalf she has accepted the prize. Menchú was invited to a reception at the National Palace. The last thing the Guatemalan government wanted was for Rigoberta Menchú to win. It had not supported her nomination and had actually nominated someone else. However, since congratulations were flooding in from all corners of the world, even from the Salvadoran government, President Serrano decided to make the best of a bad situation. Menchú has now been asked to be a mediator between the government and progressive forces, including the URNG, in peace negotiations. Rigoberta Menchú has been forced to live in exile in Mexico for the last 10 years by threats to her life, which originate from the hated Guatemalan armed forces. In July, she was able to return to Guatemala for a short visit only because she was accompanied by Madame Mitterrand, wife of the French president, to attend a conference of indigenous people from the Americas. Despite this protection, another crude attempt was made on her life. Rigoberta Menchú is a household name in Latin America and parts of Europe. Her extraordinary life became public through her book, I, Rigoberta Menchú, which had been translated in 1982. Rigoberta, a poor Guatemalan peasant woman, began her life working on the plantations picking coffee, cotton, cardamom, and cutting sugar for the wealthy landowners with her parents, brothers, and sisters. In the winter, they would return to the mountains to grow maize and live their traditional life. However, the army was driving off the Indian peasants and giving the land to the cattle ranchers. Her father decided to take up the fight to defend the community, and so began Rigoberta's political education. When General Garcia Lucas came to power in 1978, Guatemala suffered a horrifying period of mass repression, murder, and torture. The Indian peasants bore the brunt of this rampage. Rigoberta's mother, father, and brother were all killed in separate attacks by the army. Rigoberta joined the struggle with passion and dedicated commitment, becoming a national leader of the Committee for Unity of Campesinos. The Guatemalan government is understandably perturbed by her win. It knows she will not mince words and cannot be intimidated into submission. Perhaps now, with all eyes on Guatemala, the veil will be lifted on the 30-year war that has ravaged it so. On the 21st of October in 1971, Pablo Neruda won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Born in Parral, Chile, in 1904, Pablo Neruda was a poet and a revolutionary. He studied in Santiago in the 20s, and from 1927 to 1945, he was the Chilean consul in Rangoon, in Java, and then in Barcelona. Between 1970 and 1973, he served in Allende's Chilean government as ambassador to Paris. He died shortly after the coup that ended the Allende government. Neruda's poems reflect his commitment to social justice and solidarity. Here is one entitled The Dead Woman. If suddenly you do not exist, if suddenly you are not living, I shall go on living. I do not dare to write it. If you die, I shall go on living. Because where a man has no voice, there my voice. Where blacks are beaten, I cannot be dead. When my brothers go to jail, I shall go with them. When victory, not my victory, but the great victory arrives, even though I am mute, I must speak. I shall see it come, even though I am blind. No, forgive me. If you are not living, if you, beloved, my love, if you have died. By Pablo Neruda. KVMR-FM, Nevada City, California, News Director Mike Thornton is producing news stories, features, and sound portraits from the Middle East for the next 2 weeks. Mike is there as part of a global exchange reality tour. Friday, Mike attended the region's first music and censorship conference in Beirut. While it was closed to the general public for fears of reprisal and even assassination, Mike's report features music from a renowned Sufi vocalist and portions of a keynote address on censorship by Al-Sakai Books founder and artist Mike Gelsoub of London.
A two-day conference on music and censorship, the first ever of its kind taking place in North Africa or the Middle East, was sponsored by FreeMuse and the Heinrich Böll Foundation in Beirut last week. The conference concluded with a performance at Beirut's Al Medina Theater. The concert, before a packed house on Saturday evening, featured composer and oud player Ahmed Al-Khatib and percussionist Nasser Salame, both artists having been banned and censored because they were Palestinians. We spoke with both Ahmed Al-Khatib and Nasser Salame prior to the performance. Ahmed Al-Khatib.
I used to teach oud and cello and Arabic music at the National Edwardside National Conservatory in Palestine. But since the end of 2002, I had to leave Palestine for the political situation. And I'm not able to go back again, actually, because of the Israeli are not letting me to go back. So I'm still working, but from diaspora, as you said. I'm doing a musical project with the conservatory. I stayed in Jordan for 2 years, working from there, doing workshops, master classes, concerts for the benefit of the scholarship fund in the conservatory. Since September last year, I got a scholarship from the SIDA, which is the development organization that Sweden is supporting. I got a scholarship to do my graduate studies, which I'm doing now in Gothenburg University. It's in it's a combination between ethnomusicology and music education and musicology and something like that.
And you're performing this evening as part of the Music and Censorship conference that's been going on here for the last couple of days in Beirut. Talk a little bit about why that conference is important and the performance that you'll be giving tonight.
Yeah. First, I was invited to the conference, actually. It wasn't meant to do a concert because they were interested to know about my situation because they heard about the way I work. I'm working through internet and through just meeting my students outside the Palestinian territory. So they called and they asked me to participate and to do something like a personal testimony on this conference. So I accepted to come, and because I had some friends, and I know Basil, who's directing Arab Foundation, our organization. So he told me why we don't do a concert also. So I told him that was why not. It's very nice to play in Beirut, actually. So but mainly I came for the conference. But unfortunately, because you can hear my voice. And I had some difficulties, so I couldn't participate in the conference today. But I was yesterday. I had a paper to present about the conservatory and the situation or the music teaching situation in Palestine.
Talk a little bit, if you can, about what that situation is. People in the United States very often don't understand the real issues of censorship.
Yeah, it's I spoke mainly. It's different censorship in Palestine that than the other censorship that most of the participants are talking about. We our censorship is not legal because we live under an illegal occupation. Actually, it's totally different perspective. Because if this authority is not illegal, so how it's way beyond to think of censorship or expression. We are asking for the freedom of human and freedom of land. We ask for the freedom for Palestinians to move freely between the cities in between West Bank. So actually, this struggle to get freedom of Palestine is more on the scene than the freedom of expression, because it's people don't think of expression much. They express because it's part of you can say the revolution or the obsession because they are obsessed not obsessed sorry oppressed by this the occupation power. So yeah, it's I think it's a little bit different, I think. But still, to be honest, I try to, and this is what I said, I try to, or we try in the conservatory to avoid politicizing the music education process. So we try to keep politics outside the walls and the rooms of the music conservatory. We try there just to focus on the music itself, and students. You know, Palestinians are very tired from the situation, and always when you say Palestine, when you want to do a concert, when you do want to do any activity, you always label it with the situation and the freedom and so on, so on, so and even now I'm doing it, yeah, but actually at the conservatory, inside the conservatory, we try as much as we can to keep it outside, to just focus on our task to educate or to give a music education. Still, this is not easy because we can't move, I can't go there, for example. So there's a lot of obstacles, actually, but yeah, we have to face it until freedom.
Talk about the kind of music that you'll be performing.
Yeah, mainly I'm doing my composition, which is not something good. in the mean of, I'm more in the academics. I like to play more classical forms, but I did this CD, and people are interested to hear this kind of music. To be honest, I like to play my music, of course, but I have this struggle inside me between being a classical oud player, which I like. I want to be like a model for my students to play this repertoire, the old repertoire, which is dying. But at the same time, I'm facing another struggle with the phenomena that most of oud players are composing, and I have this composition, and it came by. I didn't intend to do it, but I found myself just doing this kind of composition.
Nasser Salameh.
I'm Palestinian and I live in Jordan, and I'm a member in Karluma group, which is it's a Palestinian group. It gives us the new spirit of the music, the oriental old oriental music, and me and Ahmed, we are two members of this group.
Talk about the type of music you'll be playing tonight.
Yeah, it's some of Ahmed. Ahmed's music, it's the new CD, his new CD. We are playing today, I think, 8 or 9 pieces from the CD. The CD is called Sada, and he's the master and I'm the slave in this CD.
Now, you're here in Beirut. The Music and Censorship Conference is taking place. Yeah. Talk about why it's important for you to be playing here tonight.
I think Beirut is going now through very hard conditions politically and you know what it's. And it's very nice to be here and take a place in this hard situation here in Beirut. And it's, I think Beirut is the most important place to play in the Middle East and in the whole Arab world, because it's the cultural center here in the Middle East. So it's very important for us to play here.
Is there anything in particular you'd like to communicate about the music, about the situation in Beirut and Palestine to the audience in the United States?
We are a people. Please think about us like this. Don't think that we are animals or something you have to kill, because we are all thinking of the United States citizens, that they look at us as we are not a people in their eyes, and this music can tell them that we are people.
From the Al Medina Theater in the Hamra district of Beirut, Lebanon, I'm Mike Thornton.
You can go to kvmr.org for more reports from Mike. Next, we have Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mel Goodman, former CIA analyst and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, who discusses the dangers connected with Iraq's October 15th constitutional referendum. Max Wolf, an economist at the University of Massachusetts, who talks about spending priorities in Washington in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and the billions of dollars needed to rebuild the Gulf Coast. And Jamin Raskin, professor of law at American University, who assesses President Bush's nominee to the Supreme Court, Harriet Myers. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Former Liberian strongman Charles Taylor appears to be untouchable while living in exile in southeastern Nigeria. He sleeps in a mansion, drives a pair of Land Rovers, and enjoys the latest high-tech gear. 2 years after Taylor fled Liberia, human rights activists and a United Nations tribunal in Sierra Leone, which charged the former president with 17 counts of crimes against humanity, is increasing the pressure on the deposed dictator. In early October, the United States circulated a resolution calling for UN peacekeepers in Liberia to arrest Taylor if he returns to the country and hand him over to the War Crimes Tribunal in Sierra Leone. In 2003, the Bush administration helped arrange Taylor's escape to Nigeria as rebels surrounded the Liberian capital of Monrovia. Now Desmond De Silva, head of the tribunal in Sierra Leone, is ready to present evidence against Taylor, showing his connection with the blood diamond trade. For now, Nigeria is resisting calls to hand over Taylor, saying that there are no new allegations of abuse since he fled. As Charles Echo, a human rights activist in the town where Taylor now lives, told the Washington Post, he lives like a big man. He's not living like a man afforded political asylum. Tyco lawyer Tim Flanagan is the latest target of a federal probe of Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Flanagan withdrew his name as the president's nominee for Deputy Attorney General after questions arose in the Senate Judiciary Committee about why Tyco did not investigate charges that Abramoff used $1.5 million in lobbying fees for his personal use. Abramoff, a top Bush fundraiser who has close ties to Republican power brokers like Tom DeLay, Karl Rove, Grover Norquist, and Ralph Reed, is under a wide-ranging federal investigation for misuse of Indian tribal funds while lobbying for casino interests. In late September, former Abramoff associate David Savavian was indicted while working as the procurement chief of the Office of Management and Budget. He was charged with lying about his dealings with Abramoff in 2002. The former Bush administration official is also charged with helping Abramoff lease two federal properties. Savavian went along on an Abramoff-led junket in 2002 to play golf in Scotland with Ralph Reed, the former head of the Christian Coalition, and Ohio Republican Congressman Bob Ney. The trip cost $130,000. Savavian's lawyer, Barbara Van Gelder, called the federal indictment an attempt to prove guilt by association. The fate of synthetic agents like food ripeners and organic produce has pitted consumers against producers. According to The Grist, an online environmental magazine, the Organic Trade Association, which represents producers like Dole, Kraft, and Horizon, is pushing an amendment to the 2006 Agriculture Bill to preserve the use of synthetic agents in food certified as organic. The Grassroots Organics Consumer Association strongly opposed the amendment out of a fear that it would weaken the National Organic Standards Board, an independent body that devised federal organic standards. Due to strong activist opposition to the amendment, the Senate bill only called for a new study of the synthetic issue. Without the amendment, William Friedman, a lobbyist for the organic producers, says nearly 90% of multi-ingredient products like breakfast cereals, bread, and milk would have to be relabeled. Urvashi Rangan of Consumers Union says there is a great deal of corporate pressure to expand the use of synthetic agents in organic food. However, a recent poll showed consumers overwhelmingly expected organic food to be free of any artificial ingredients. In essence, Rangan says, allowing the use of synthetics erodes the credibility of the word organic. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
As Iraq's constitutional referendum approaches, attacks by insurgents have escalated, resulting in carnage that is only expected to get more intense. Car bombings, ambushes, and mortar attacks carried out by combatants resisting the U.S. occupation and opposed to the proposed constitution have many observers concerned that the October 15th vote may fan the flames of conflict, possibly catapulting the nation into a full-blown civil war. News reports alleging that death squads targeting Sunni Muslims have been operated by the Iraqi government's interior ministry have only heightened tensions. One of the most contentious provisions of the draft constitution would sanction the autonomous zone in the oil-rich Kurdish north and allow for a similar zone in the Shiite south. Many Iraqis of Sunni descent oppose the autonomous zones, fearing that this will inevitably lead to the breakup of Iraq into three separate nations. Other objections have been raised about the status of women under the proposed new constitution, where family disputes such as divorce, child custody, and inheritance will be referred to religious courts where women have little or no rights. The draft charter can be defeated if a two-thirds majority votes no in three of Iraq's 18 provinces, a goal that Sunni leaders say they will campaign for. The October referendum will be followed by a December vote for a new parliament. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Goodman assesses the dangers connected with Iraq's constitutional referendum.
Well, I think the Constitution is more important to an American audience than it is to an Iraqi audience. The Americans have been led to believe, falsely in my estimation, that the document will mark the best way to go to Iraqi independence and therefore begin the process of American withdrawal from Iraq. I don't feel that way. I think Iraqis are quite cynical about the document. They know it's a document that was in part imposed on them during a U.S. occupation. And I think most Iraqis look at the document as a destabilizing document. And in some ways, and this is the paradox in the situation, that the Iraqis might be better off if the vote, the referendum, goes against the Constitution than if the vote, the referendum, goes in favor of the Constitution. And I say that because the document really was designed in a way to produce independent status for the Shiites in the south of Iraq and the Kurds in the north of Iraq, and really doesn't do a great deal for the central part of the country where you have most of the Sunnis who represent at least 20% of the population, and then very important Shiite populations in Baghdad and the surrounding area. So I think we've gotten a misimpression about the value of the Constitution. And frankly, the notion of Iraq becoming a democracy and the Constitution being the first step in that direction, given the fact that there are no democracies in the Arab world, I think is a pipe dream in many ways.
Mel Goodman, in discussing some of the flaws you see in the proposed Iraqi Constitution, could you talk a little bit more about the divisions within Iraqi society between ethnic and religious groups that you think this document might exacerbate?
Yes. Well, there are several kinds of divisions. There are religious divisions in terms of Sunnis and Shiites and their interpretation of the Quran and their way of practicing Islam. There are the ethnic differences between the Kurds in the north and then the Sunnis and Shiites in the center in the southern part of the country. There are important differences between former Ba'athist party members, that is, party members who had some allegiance to Saddam Hussein but weren't close or passionate supporters of Saddam Hussein. And then the Constitution itself has some contradictions built into it between will the country be a democratic country with democratic principles, or will this be an Islamic country in which allegiance to Islam and to the Quran will supersede and overtake anything with regard to democratic rule or sovereignty issues. So there are these differences, and when you add to that the economic differences, which the Constitution probably can say nothing about, but in any event certainly doesn't say anything about, how do you divide up the great wealth of the Iraqi nation, mainly in terms of the oil holdings that are in the north and the Kurdish part of the country and the south where the Shias predominate, and how in the world do you share these resources and the value of these resources with the central part of the country where the Sunnis have large population groups as well as very important members of the Shiite community. So the Constitution really doesn't settle any of these things. And a lot of these issues can only be settled after the constitutional phase has passed us by. But if the Constitution is defeated, then you're in a situation where you have to start all over again. If the Constitution is accepted, then I think there will be great differences between this Sunni minority, which is still a powerful minority, and the fact that the insurgency, to a great extent, is fed by Sunni resistance. And then I think the Shiites will then be in a very difficult situation.
How real is the possibility, in your view, that Iraq may, in the near to not too distant future, be three separate countries?
I think there's the possibility that the events in Iraq will lead toward a three-way division, and even worse, a three-way division that's accompanied by a civil war that could last for decades. Not too long ago, I went back to the memoirs that George Herbert Walker Bush and his national security advisor, General Brent Scowcroft, wrote about the 4 years between 1989 and 1993, and of course, they talk about the Persian Gulf War and why they didn't do certain things and Desert Storm and in the wake of Desert Storm. And their argument for not going into Baghdad, I think, was very convincing. And it's a shame that the then-president's son, the current president, didn't read that paragraph because it deals with the threat of fragmentation in the country. And in the wake of fragmentation, it not only deals with the possibility of civil war and chaos within the country, but then the external factors, the fact that Iran would have a great deal of leverage and influence over the Shiite part of the country, that Turkey would have a great deal of opposition to the Kurdish north, Syria would be able to manipulate a very porous and insecure border on the western part of Iraq, which we're seeing already, and that the Saudis would then try to also exercise some influence in the country, particularly with regard to the oil holdings. And this was the great argument that Herbert Walker Bush and Brent Scowcroft put forward for why they stuck to the original mission of Desert Storm, which was to make sure that the Iraqis were removed from Kuwait and that the United States shouldn't try to extend a permanent presence in Iraq. And I think it holds up very well. It was written, the war was fought in 91, the memoir came out around 94, 95, and here we are 10 years later, and I think their logic is rather compelling.
That was Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Contact the center by calling area code 202-232-3317 or visit their website at www.ciponline.org. Hurricane Katrina exposed the face of grinding endemic poverty in America, especially among people of color. After the Bush administration's much-criticized response to the killer storm, the president responded by committing up to $200 billion needed to rebuild New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. But the spending priorities of the White House and Congress could increase poverty among the very population most affected by the hurricane. Meanwhile, the war in Iraq has cost about $200 billion to date. Tax cuts favoring the wealthy are scheduled to take more than a $1 trillion bite out of the federal budget. Yet, in the face of the Gulf Coast disaster, President Bush and the Republican leadership in Congress oppose any effort to scale back tax breaks. Republican leaders in Congress have recently cautioned against spending a large amount on Gulf Coast reconstruction and have proposed massive cuts in social services, but not the military, to offset relief spending. And in response to the latest global disaster, the earthquake in Pakistan, Bush immediately pledged $50 million in aid, with more promised, to President Pervez Musharraf, a staunch U.S. ally in Washington's war against terrorism. Many observers are now asking, where will all this money come from? Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Max Wolf, an economist at the University of Massachusetts. He talks about all the zeros being tossed around in Washington and the real-world consequences of various tax and spending proposals.
We began to hear huge numbers, $200 billion, which is a large number. Interestingly, it's about the same magnitude of the official direct spending on Iraq so far, so it's a large number. Within a few weeks, or even less actually, there started to be concern for the first time from the Republican Party in 5 years of crazy budget-busting activity, and the idea that, hey, this $200 billion, this is going to have a real budget impact, which over several years it would, but it wouldn't be one of the biggest impacts or one of the biggest, most expensive programs. I would call people's attention to the heavy-on-the-pork recent highway bill, which builds bridges to nowhere and costs about 150%+ as much as the $200 billion, the Katrina-suggested amount, so it's about $350 billion. And the tax cuts enacted in 2001 and 2003, the full cost of which are yet to come into the economy, which will cost, with provisions, somewhere in the range of $1.5 to $2 trillion over the next 10 years, so 10 times almost the size of Katrina. And suddenly there was a desire to look for some ways to, one, possibly reduce the spending on Katrina, so that $200 billion mark was kind of drawn down. The targets are now lower. The Republican study group has suggested, A, that we spend less than the $200, much less, maybe on the order of half, on the Gulf Coast recovery, and that a bunch of cuts in spending in other areas be enacted to offset some of the budget damage. And sadly and unfortunately, because part of what I think Katrina could have done, should have done, and maybe began to do, was to highlight the plight of those left behind by the U.S. economy. And that's not a small number. I think we're talking on the order of 20 to 40% of the public. There was some interest in that and the idea that something should be done. Unfortunately, if we funded Katrina with the cuts proposed by the Republican study group, we'll be taking money from one group of low-income people to give it in the idea of helping another. And the reality of where the Katrina money goes may not be the same thing as the rhetoric, as is often the case. And so early suggestions of some places to do cutting include Medicare, Medicaid, something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which particularly helps struggling families, some provisioning of money for health clinics for people who earn less than 200% of the rather shamefully low federal poverty line, which is only a little more than $9,500 per person now. And so it has a nasty look that if those proposals are accepted, which is an if, they would be transferring money from one group of needy people, creating worse situation for them, in the hope and following the rhetoric of helping another group of needy people and just others affected by Katrina.
Max Wolf, do you know if anybody in the government is talking about cutting the military budget at all in any way?
Not so much that I've heard. I have heard discussions, serious discussions from high-level people in the financial world and the administration to the effect that the rate of increase in the defense budget cannot and will not be as high as it has been recently. So to that extent, massive looming increases in the defense budget seem to have been put on the back burner for now. As for a drawdown in the overall size, like an absolute reduction in the defense budget, I have heard nothing to that effect, other than from the people who have been, for various reasons, calling from it for a long time.
Can you explain where things stand in terms of making the tax cuts permanent?
Budget deficits for government spending more in a year than it brings in revenue are obviously caused by two things. A, spending too much, the only one you ever hear about, and B, not bringing in enough money, because of course this is a balancing game. The half of the debate we haven't been discussing is that in 2001 and 2003, massive tax cuts were instituted, proposed by the President, in some cases extended and amended by the House and Senate, which, if extended, look to do about $1.5 trillion worth of damage to the revenue that the federal government collects. This would mean that to stay anything like balanced, the federal government would have to cut spending. Instead, we have raised spending. The way those tax cuts were pushed through was to kind of control and play around with the mathematics and the forecasting on the numbers. The way this was done is to have them not kick in or begin effect until later. So some of them kick in only in 2006, the year coming. And they phased in, and initially it was said they would be temporary. That way you could come out with estimates that made them look smaller in their total reducing of the federal government's income than they actually are. So some of what's going on with increasing negative pressure on the budget, making it largely a larger budget deficit, is that some of these tax revisions are coming in. In addition to which, there's a heavy movement, particularly before Katrina, but I don't think there's been a sea change since, to keep these tax cuts in place and to continue to allow them to come in as per the program and to take away what was largely just a hustle, basically, to make them look cheaper and make them officially permanent.
That was Max Wolf, an economist at the University of Massachusetts. Read his commentaries online at www.prudentbear.com. In November, Wolf will be launching a new website at www.globalmacroscope.com. President Bush's selection of Harriet Myers to fill the Supreme Court seat being vacated by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor sent shockwaves through the Washington establishment. Myers, the president's longtime friend who currently serves as White House counsel, has no experience as a judge and little, if any, paper trail to determine her judicial philosophy. Charges of cronyism were directed at the president's choice by Democrats and Republicans alike. Before becoming Mr. Bush's personal attorney, Myers headed up the Texas State Bar Association and was later appointed by then-Governor Bush to become chair of the Texas Lottery Commission. Although White House officials have privately reassured nervous Republican senators and Christian fundamentalist leaders about Myers' conservative and anti-abortion credentials, some on the right, like Kansas GOP Senator Sam Brownback, have publicly criticized the president's choice and may vote against her. Confusing the situation was Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid's endorsement of Myers. She was on the Democrats' list of suggested nominees. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jamin Raskin, professor of law at American University, who assesses the Myers nomination and what's at stake for the nation.
You know, when Roberts took over for Rehnquist, you had one ideologically motivated right-wing conservative taking the place of another, and in fact, essentially moving in to fill the shoes of his mentor and the justice he clerked for. But O'Connor is someone who is also on the conservative side, make no mistake of that. But on a number of issues, she sort of slices the bologna very fine and oftentimes ends up voting with the liberals. So, for example, on affirmative action, she saved affirmative action with the liberals in the Michigan undergraduate and law school affirmative action cases. On abortion, she has helped to retain the core abortion right that was identified in Roe versus Wade, although she has relaxed the standard, so allowed the states to regulate more. But on other issues, she's clearly been conservative. She engineered the whole move to dismantle majority black and Hispanic congressional districts, and she's generally been a reliable conservative vote on criminal procedure. But there's been enough on social issues, especially women's rights issues, that liberals have come to be gratified by her presence on the court. And now, if Myers takes over and she ends up like Justices Scalia and Thomas, that's going to be a very radical turnaround in terms of the politics of the court.
Jamie Raskin, how out of the ordinary is this appointment of the president's attorney to such a high position? Charges of cronyism have been swirling around this administration for a number of years, and many point to this as another example of the same thing. What's your view of that?
Some people have likened it to nomination by President Johnson of Abe Fortas, who was an attorney in private practice and a very great friend of President Johnson's. But this is truly something unique because she has no real stature as a constitutional thinker. She's never served as a federal judge or a state judge. She's never been a law professor. She's never written anything to anyone's knowledge about constitutional law. She doesn't seem to have any well-developed jurisprudential views, and her chief credentials appear to be having served as the chief of the Texas State Bar and basically, you know, having been the president's lawyer, both in a personal capacity and now in the White House. But her career is completely identified with George W. Bush, and so this leads Democrats to suppose that she's going to be a reliable vote with the conservatives, but the conservative ideologues are upset that there's not someone who is much more of a known quantity, their mantra being no more suitors. They still feel burned by the first President Bush's nomination of Justice David Souter, who's now turned out probably to be the most progressive justice on the court.
Reverend James Dobson has reportedly told others in the Christian fundamentalist movement that he's been assured by White House insiders that Harriet Myers will cast a vote to overturn Roe versus Wade, a woman's right to choose abortion if she wishes, the law of the land as it stands right now. There is some talk that Dobson may be subpoenaed to come and testify before the Senate Confirmation Committee looking at the nomination of Harriet Myers. How important is that, do you think?
Well, it's a critical development. The U.S. Senate, according to the Constitution, of course, exercises advice and consent powers over judicial nominations. So The senators are rightfully asking the question, what does James Dobson know that we don't know? And if there's information that's good enough for the religious right to have, it certainly should be good enough for the senators who have to vote on the nomination. But I think it does reflect the political problem facing the Bush administration, which is caught between a rock and a hard place. They need to demonstrate her right-wing credentials to quell the protest on the right. But the more they do that and tip their hand, the more the Democrats will know that this is someone who's been named to the court simply for the ideological reasons to vote a party line. And so the more that Dobson and Falwell and these people reassure the faithful that she's going to do the right thing on all of their issues, the more the Democrats are able to say, not only is this a person completely unqualified for the court, as many Republicans and conservatives like Charles Krauthammer have been saying, but she's someone who's unqualified, who's been sent up there essentially to cast votes as a kind of a party machine robot.
How aggressive are the Democrats likely to be in putting hard questions to Harriet Myers or engaging in a filibuster to stop this nomination from going forward?
Well, I think, you know, in truth, it's sort of a delicious moment for the Democrats. They were all set to be out there with their knives out, you know, attacking and deconstructing the record of the nominee. At this point, they can just sit back in their easy chair and watch the Republicans do it. In fact, you notice that some of the senators, like Patrick Leahy, have been enjoying the spectacle of getting up and saying, this is a very interesting moderate candidate, and I think Harry Reid even took credit for suggesting her. So they're trying to fan the flames on the right by emphasizing the extent to which they see her as a possible moderate and someone they could work with and so on, knowing that that is going to further enrage the right and make them, you know, ever more suspicious. I mean, I think that they're prepared to go after her if they need to. So I think if somehow they're able to get all of the right-wing troops in order, then the Democrats will really have to get serious and put her record under a microscope and go after her. But they may not have to do that, because if any significant Republican opposition remains, the 45 Democratic senators are going to be in a very good position to join with a handful of Republicans to stop the nomination.
That was Jamin Raskin, professor of law at American University. He is the author of Overruling Democracy, the Supreme Court versus the American People. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome your participation, too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays, 2 to 4, if you're not in range of the station, by going to www.wirenh.com. And remember that WSCA is looking for your membership and your participation. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you now with this quote by Maya Angelou, which we dedicate to the women of Afghanistan. Just like the moons and the suns, with a certainty of the tides, just like hopes springing high, still all rise.